So this is what, 15th January in 2012. We're looking at Bhagavad Gita. We're looking at chapter 18, the perfection of renunciation, text 69, 68, and 69.7. So in text 68, Krishna says, "Ya idam padamam guyam mad bhaktesh yadvasyati bhakti mai paramkritva." Mam evash yas sasamshaya. For one who explains the supreme secret to the devotees, pure devotional service is guaranteed, and the end he will come back to me. Srila Prabhupada's purport. Generally, it is advised that Bhagavad Gita be discussed amongst the devotees only. For those who are not devotees will understand neither Krishna nor Bhagavad Gita. Those who do not accept Krishna as he is and Bhagavad Gita as it is should not try to explain Bhagavad Gita whimsically and become offenders. Bhagavad Gita should be explained to persons who are ready to accept Krishna as a supreme personality of Godhead. It is a subject matter for the devotees only and not for philosophical speculators. Anyone, however, who tries sincerely to present Bhagavad Gita as it is will advance in devotional activities and reach the pure devotional stage of life. As a result of such pure devotion, he is sure to go back home, back to God. And the next verse, just read the English. There is no servant in this world more... Want me to say again? 18, 68, 69, and 70. Chapter 18... Okay, 1868, very end of the book. Just last verses before you come to the index. And 69. We'll read through the English again, end of 68, 69, and 70. For one who explains the supreme secret to the devotees, pure devotional service is guaranteed. At the end, he will come back to me. Prabhupada is translating a samsaya without doubt as guaranteed. Then there is no servant in this world more dear to me than he, nor will there ever be one more dear. And I declare that he who studies the sacred conversation of ours worships me by his intelligence. We very much welcome the next generation. No problem. No problem. She's fine. As long as she's fine. She's fine. Please, stay. Unless she's screaming. If she's screaming, you have to leave. But if she's just making happy baby noises, that's fine. No problem.
Small question.
Begrijpt iedereen voldoende Engels? Iemand die daar problemen mee heeft?
So as I'm sure most of you are aware, Srila Prabhupada has brought us this philosophy explaining what is the perfection of life. That the perfection of life is to be again with Krishna in his spiritual abode, Goloka Vrindavan, and rendering pure devotional service to him. That's our, as Prabhupada would say, our original position our constitutional nature. To be who we are. Now, the psychologists talk about self-actualization, finding yourself, realizing who you are, what is your right place. There's many courses and books you can take on how to find the right career. There's a very famous book, at least in America, called What Color Is Your Parachute? Where a person tries to understand, what is my nature? Who am I? What things am I really good at? Where will I be best situated? So naturally, we all want to find the place where we feel not just comfortable, where we can shine, where we can really express ourselves to the fullest, where we can discover what our real talents are, what our real nature is, where I fit into this whole scheme of things. Where is my right place? Where can I be fully me, fully who I am in the most wonderful way, and also be fully part of everything else, not just be fully who I am in isolation. So what we learn from the beginning of Bhagavad Gita is that who I ultimately am, I have some temporary identity in this world that even in this life changes. So who I am and where I fit and the right thing for me to do and how I can find myself in an external way changes over the course of this life. Right? For a little child like this, who I am and where I belong is I belong in my mommy's arms, and that's the end of that, right? I belong to have mommy pick me up and I have some toy to play with, and then that's who I am and where I belong. But that's not enough for the rest of us anymore. As we develop in life, that changes who I am, where I belong, how I can really express myself. And those changing identities are not our ultimate self. We have some sense of a continuous identity through those changing identities. We can say, I was a baby. I mean, I remember, how old is she?
A year and something.
It's a little more than a year. So I can remember being around 2 years old. I can remember before I could speak. So somewhere around that age maybe. I can't remember younger than that. Although I know some people who can remember younger than that. But I remember being about two. I remember being four. I can remember going to school on the school bus. And the older children would roll up their notebook and hit the younger children over the head. And I remember complaining to the teachers, and then when I got to be an older child, I was doing that also to the little children. So I can remember that. But my sense of self is quite different. My sense of who I am, where I belong, how I can express, that's all changed. But I have this continuing sense of self. So in the beginning of Bhagavad Gita, Krishna says this continuing sense of self, this I. I was 2 years old. I was in my mother's arms. I was on the school bus. I went this place. I did this. Who is this I? He says, Ajo nitya shaspato yam purano. Ajo, this real I is not born. It's eternal. It's never dying. And Krishna says in the beginning that there was not any time in the past when we did not exist as ourselves, and there'll be no time in the future that we do not exist as ourselves. And who is this self? He says, Mamai vamso jiva loke jiva bhuta sanatana. He said, this self is an amsa. It's a part of the Supreme. We have the same nature as the Supreme, and we're part of the Supreme. So that gives us a little idea, in a very general way, of who I am and where I belong. I'm a spirit, I'm a spiritual being, and I belong as part of the Supreme Spirit. Little idea, but that's very vague. That's just like if I said, all right, your identity is that you're human, and you're part of human society. It doesn't tell you much. It tells you something, but not so much. Okay, well, if I'm human and I'm part of human society, then I guess I should try to do good for humanity. And I think, how do human beings behave? And I try to behave like a human being. So if I understand that actually I'm spirit and I'm part of the whole spirit, then I understand that I have a give and take relationship with the whole spirit, just like in my human identity, which is a temporary identity, I have a give and take relationship with humanity. Right? The human society provides for me, and I try to give something back to human society. And I can understand I must have activities related to the spirit, just like I have activities related to that of a human being, but it's still very, very, very vague. And then Krishna explains that he is that supreme spirit. Mata parataram nanyat kinchit asti janandaya. That the ultimate truth is the person Krishna, because people often think that the spirit is just something vague, but Krishna says, no, brahmanohi pratistaham amritasya vyaschicha shasvachasya chajarmasya sukasya kantikasya. He says, I am the basis of just this Brahman, the white light, the energy, which is the constitutional position of ultimate happiness. Oh, so now I understand that I have a give-and-take relationship with the personality of Godhead. And a little bit of this is explained in the Bhagavad Gita, where Krishna says things like, patram pushpam phalam toyam, you can give me fruits and flowers and leaves and water. I was just reading about one woman's first visit to a Hare Krishna center, and she was amazed to see somebody put some fruits on the altar. She thought, oh, why are they offering food to God? So we have some idea that our ultimate relationship has to do with giving and taking things like that, the kind of things we give and take with people we love in this world. If you have friends in this world, you feed them, and they feed you, and you give them gifts, and you speak your mind, and you do fun things with them. So that's actually what we do with Krishna. And we do this, and of course Bhagavad Gita gets into this in only a very beginning way, and more detail in books like the Srimad Bhagavatam and in the Nectar of Devotion, the Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu, which was written by one of the main followers of Krishna's avatar, Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, gets into the fact that we each have a very individual identity, just like saying I'm human, but I have a very individual identity as a man or a woman, or is from this nationality or that nationality, am I a political liberal or conservative? There's nuances that comes down. You can have, okay, there's two main categories of human, male and female, and then under that there's different categories. Under that there's different categories of personality and nationality, until you come just to me or you, that we have as a unique individual. So the same thing applies spiritually. That spiritually, everyone is a unique individual in a personal relationship with Krishna. So some persons have a relationship with Krishna as if he's their master, some as if he's their friend, some as if the Lord is their child. Generally, we think most Western religions emphasize God as the Father. That certainly he is. Aham bija prata pita. Pita means father. So certainly Krishna is the ultimate father. But in love, one sees the Lord as one's child or as one's beloved. And that one has these relationships. Then within these relationships, there's subcategories and sub-subcategories and sub-subcategories until you come to, again, each individual soul has an individual relationship with God. Just like each of us has an individual temporary human identity, so we have an ultimate spiritual identity in relationship to the Supreme Spirit and in relationship to all the other spiritual beings. Like I have a relationship to sort of humanity in general and then to each other human. And this happens in a place, although it's interesting because although we talk about the place of the spiritual world, that place is beyond time and space. The first aspect of the creation of the material world is time. Actually, in the ultimate reality, there's no time. Everything's the present. Everything happens now. And many things are happening, but they're all happening now. There's no, I mean, actually time is a very funny thing. Nobody really knows what it is. We talk about time as the rate of change, the rate of degradation, or as the measurement of the movement of one celestial body in comparison to another celestial body. But what exactly it is? I mean, even space is a hard thing to define. We tend to define... Is there some room for you to come sit down? We have some cushions here, I think, and some chairs, please. Do you know English? Okay, there's plenty of room. Maybe some people actually move up so that... Because when people come in, they never like to come to the front. So you can put some cushions maybe in the back for them. So even space, we have a difficult time. We tend to define space by the boundaries. You know, we know there's a space here because it has walls and a roof and a floor. But what is actually the space? How do we define what is space? And time is much harder to define. So the beginning of the creation of this world is time. And soon after that is created space. So space and time do not exist outside of the material creation. So in the ultimate reality, the ultimate spiritual world, there's no space and time. Yet we talk about the spiritual world as a place. And in fact, it's described earlier in the Bhagavad Gita that it's a self-luminous place that doesn't require sunlight, moonlight, or electricity. And yet, the Vedas describe it as a place. They say that the spiritual reality is three-quarters of existence. I mean, not technically, not like you could measure it. But in other words, the vast majority of reality is spiritual. That this material reality is a very small part of reality. You could say, utmost, one-fourth of reality. So when one remembers one's real identity and one's place in that reality, then one attains to the realization of that ultimate reality beyond time and space. So how to get there? How to get to this ultimate realization, which is called by various names in different traditions. You know, enlightenment or nirvana, or self-realization, or God-realization. These are not all talking about exactly the same levels, because there's various levels also of enlightenment, just like there's various levels materially of self-understanding. But how one attains to that is even in this world of illusion, even in this world of temporary changing false identities. Our identities in this world are taken on like actors take on an identity in a drama. So if you've ever been, anyone here been in drama? Anybody here been in drama? Okay, so you know you put on a costume and you put on makeup and you also take on the mentality of the character that you're playing. So I was recently in a drama where I played a character who was a comic character, but a comic character that the audience was laughing at, not laughing with. And it was a very childlike character. My character would change from one emotion to another very, very quickly and was very unaware of what was going on. That other persons in the drama were having jokes at this character's expense. So I had to enter into the mood of that character in order to play the drama. I couldn't act as myself. It wasn't just putting on the costume and the makeup. So in this world, in this life, and from one life to the next, we're playing different roles, none of which is us. Right? So how do I get to this real identity? And when I really establish my relationship with Krishna, the ultimate spirit, the whole of which I am a part, then I revive, I remember my real identity, even in this world. You know, if you're in a drama, and while you're in the drama, you notice in the audience some of your friends and family, it distracts you from your character, doesn't it? And you start remembering who you are. It's like in this drama I was in, my grown-up daughter was also playing a role. But in the drama, I wasn't relating to her as my daughter. We were relating as the characters in the drama. But if at any time I had thought, oh, that's my daughter, then I would have broken that character. I would have remembered who I am outside of the play. So in a similar way, even while we're in this body, even while we're in this world, if we, again, look to the Supreme Spirit, then we remember, oh, I'm actually a spiritual being. I'm not really part of this world. And the relationship that I have, we were saying that there's five main kinds of relationship. They're all relationships of love. They're all give and take relationships of love. And the secret, therefore, to accelerating my coming to the stage of enlightenment is to increase that love. Now, if I love somebody, we were talking before that Krishna's asked for things like flowers and fruit and water, not because he needs them, but because he wants to have a loving exchange. But the main loving exchange that we have is giving of ourselves. That's the ultimate gift that we make to someone we love, isn't it? Just like my father and I were very, very close from the time I was very young, not much older than that. So he would get up very early every morning. He'd get up about maybe 5 o'clock. And he'd wake me up by 5:30. And we'd spend 2 hours together every morning before he went to work. And he was a very busy man. He ran, he was the CEO of a multinational corporation. But still, he gave his little daughter 2 hours every morning. And until I went away to college, university, I would spend 2 hours every morning with him. So that was that giving of himself to me was really indicative. It really showed me how much he loved me, much more so than someone just giving me a gift or someone just saying, oh, I love you. No, that he was willing to spend his time with me and give me himself. So that's our ultimate expression of love, of friendship. And the ultimate thing also that Krishna wants is he wants us to give ourselves. Now, of course, he's giving himself to us. In fact, Krishna is giving himself to us all the time. He says in the Bhagavad Gita that he's the ability in a living being. He's our intelligence. He's our strength. He's our memory, our knowledge, even our forgetfulness. Sometimes we want to forget things also. We don't always want to remember everything. So the ability to forget, the ability to remember, the ability to have knowledge. He's the one who lights our heart with understanding. Whenever we're trying to learn something and we say, oh, now I get it. That's Krishna. He's the digestive fire. You know, we don't have a fire in our stomach like you'd have from a match. We have a chemical fire that oxidizes our food and turns it from, you know, bread and carrots into muscles and bones. And that process, that is Krishna. The light, that is Krishna. The warmth, that is Krishna. So Krishna is giving us himself sound, all sounds. That is also Krishna. So Krishna is giving us himself constantly. Without reservation, without consideration. It's not that only theistic people or spiritual people have ability and memory. Atheistic people have ability and memory. Evil people. Evil people digest their food and hear sounds and have ability and have intelligence. Just the sun shines on everyone. The rain rains everywhere. It's not discriminating. So Krishna is giving himself totally and freely to everyone. And what he's asking is that we also give. Of course, my giving, if I give myself, I'm very small. I can't give to him like he's giving to me. But that's what he's asking. And giving in love. Not giving in slavery. But giving freely, without any conditions. Real loving giving, there's no conditions. If I actually love somebody, I don't say, well, I'm giving myself to you because I'm hoping you'll do this and this for me. Or I'm giving myself to you because I don't really want to, but I know socially I'm supposed to. You know, there's nothing pushing me from behind or drawing me from in front when I give out of love. I just give. I say, here I am. I love you. And that's enough. That's all. Whatever you want from me, whatever you want to freely give in exchange, I'm happy. I don't want to obligate you to give anything, nor am I giving out of obligation. We don't usually find in this world that kind of love very often. But that's what we're aspiring to. That's what we're trying to get, this sort of relationship, where you are freely giving to me without any obligation, without any expectation, except this free exchange of love. So that's what Krishna's asking. But he says, if you want to be the most dear, if you want to attain the state of enlightenment, for sure, a samsayaha, he says, as Prabhupada says here, guaranteed, then you bring others to this also. You don't come alone. Bring others also out of illusion, into the light, into freedom, into reality. Because ultimately, what Krishna wants is that everyone come to real happiness. So that is the essence of our practice in this Krishna conscious society. We're not only interested in our own salvation and in our own enlightenment. We're certainly interested in our own enlightenment, because I can't bring other people to love of God if I'm not also going. Just like we got a ride to Antwerp, so our driver had to come too. Right? It's not that our driver just says, it's not Arvind Daksha, it's not he just says, okay, I'm going to turn on the car, it's going to take you automatically while I stay in, what do you call it, Dubois?
Derby.
Sorry, if you speak French, I just destroyed your language. So it's not like that. He had to come with us. So if I'm going to bring others to enlightenment, I also have to go. There's no question of my not going. And why does that accelerate my own process? Because that's the kind of loving exchange that Krishna ultimately wants. Krishna wants all of the living beings that are in illusion, not only in human bodies, but even in plant bodies and in insect bodies and in animal bodies, no matter what body the soul is in due to its material desires and cycle of reincarnation, he wants everyone to become enlightened. So this society exists to facilitate the individual journey. Because it's hard to take that individual step to enlightenment alone. It's very difficult, especially in modern society, but I think it's always been difficult to do it alone. Modern society very much pushes against enlightenment. In our modern society, we're told, enlightenment is nonsense. It doesn't exist. There is nothing spiritual. In fact, the modern scientists say there's nothing even mental. They say there's only the physical. They say the mind is simply the brain. There's no mind. Of course, there's so much evidence that there's mind. Otherwise, how do people have out-of-body experiences and they're on the operating table in surgery and then they're floating on the ceiling and they can see the tag on the light bulb? How is that possible if there's no mind? But anyway, the prevailing propaganda, the prevailing paradigm, is that we are nothing other than this body and this brain. This life is simply a chance combination of chemicals that came about due to billions and billions and billions of mistakes. Some chance mutation and mistake that gradually over billions of years happened to create us. And we're just some sort of a cosmic aberration and joke with no real meaning and purpose other than that which we imagine. And anything that's spiritual or religious or mystical is just some sort of a strange fluke of evolution for primitive people to try to imagine that there was meaning in a meaningless universe. So this is the prevailing paradigm, and therefore if you say, hey, I really want to find out who I am and I really want to develop my relationship with the Supreme Spirit, and I really want to find enlightenment and have spiritual experiences and find my spiritual identity, you're a little weird. You're a little out of the ordinary. you're going to be going against the social norms. So therefore, doing it alone is very difficult. We're social creatures, and it's hard for us on our own individually to go against the current of the social norms. So we have the society to support one another in our spiritual search. And the ultimate issue of spiritual search is a very individual thing. It's a very internal, individual, deep, and personal awakening. You know, even if many people are sleeping in the same room and all wake up together, each one of them is still waking up personally. But the other reason that the society exists is so we can work together to help people in general, so that we can cooperate together and we can form a society in order to bring enlightenment to other living beings, not just to hold it for ourselves. So, of course, here we don't have so much facility, but even one determined person in the world can do so much. What to speak of a group together? So one should be thinking, now I've gotten this wonderful gift of knowledge that there's a spiritual world, that I'm a spiritual being, that I have a relationship with Krishna, and my relationship with Krishna is starting to awaken. Let me share it with others. Just like someone who becomes very wealthy, they often want to share their wealth. They start charity organizations to try to bring their good fortune to others. And we do this at least with our friends. You know, if we get something really nice, we want to share it with our friends. So Krishna is saying that if you share this secret knowledge, that we are something more than the body and mind, we are an eternal being with an eternal individual identity of love, and that the Supreme Spirit is a person with whom we have a personal relationship of love, that this world is an illusion just made of the flickering lights of the modes of material nature, like a movie is made out of just three colors of lights, that this isn't our real place, it's a stage, it's a drama in which I'm taking on different identities, that if you share this secret with others, that your own enlightenment, your own spiritual consciousness becomes greatly accelerated. So each of us, if we think about how can I do that? What can I do in order to help the world become a place of enlightenment? And not to think, oh, it's impossible. It can't be done. I mean, if we read the litany of the horrors and the evils in the newspapers that happen every day in the world, we may think that just coming to a world where people are nice to each other regularly is impossible. What to speak of a world of enlightenment? But it's not impossible. And it's not that just because the problem is this big that the solution has to be this big. Well, the solution is actually very small. It's a very slight change in consciousness. Instead of I am something material, it's I am spiritual. Not getting rid of the I am. Instead of the things in this world are mine, my relationship with Krishna is mine. Krishna is mine. I am Krishna's. Krishna is mine. Instead of I'm doing these things so that I can make money and I can get a nice place to live and I can get some respect in the world, I'm doing these things, so I'm doing the same things practically. Same things. Only a few things in Krishna consciousness one cannot do. One cannot be killing and eating animals. One cannot be eating meat, fish, or eggs, having illicit sex, taking intoxication, or gambling. But other than that, whatever one is doing, I mean, you can't run a crime organization for enlightenment. But anything else that you're doing, you can do that very thing to achieve purification and enlightenment. You don't have to change the externals of what you're doing, just the consciousness. And to help enlighten others, all you need to change is your consciousness in your dealing with them. It's one of those things, you know, like two parallel lines. If one moves over 1 millimeter, then you end up with a huge difference. So a very, very small, it's a very small change in consciousness. Very, very small. It's not that you have to do some huge difference in your life in order to have a huge effect, or a huge difference in what you're doing in the world to have a huge effect. So this is the purpose of our sangha, of our association, to facilitate the very personal, very inner, very individual, coming to real full enlightenment of who I am and what is my relationship with Krishna. That I can exist in the spiritual world, even in this life and even in this body. And also we have the Sangha to bring this to others, to bring especially the holy name of Krishna to others, to bring these books about Krishna to others, to bring the sanctified prasadam food to others, and to just bring enlightenment to others through our own being and our own association. So if each of us can think, what would I like to do? If there were no restrictions, if I had as much money as I needed and as much talent as I needed and as much help as I needed, what would I like to do to bring enlightenment to the world? And you can even write this down. You know, what is your dream of what you'd like to do for the world? What you'd like to do to make Krishna happy and to unite yourself with Krishna? And then you take that dream and you present it to Krishna and you say, I'd like to do this for you. And then see what he arranges. And you see what kind of doors he'll open and what he'll arrange and what people he'll send to help you and what resources he'll send to help you. And, you know, you could make Antwerp an enlightened city. It's not impossible. It's not impossible. It takes some courage and some trust that actually anything is possible when I allow myself to work with the ultimate spiritual reality that is beyond time and space, that is beyond the restrictions of my material identity and of which I am a part. So we have a little time, and we can have time. I hope, did you all understand my English? Was I speaking slowly enough? The problem is if I speak really slowly, then people get tired. So I try to speak slowly enough so that those who don't have English as their first language can understand, but then the pace is a little down. So if anyone has questions or comments, and you don't have to ask a question just on the subject I talked about, but on anything that you'd like at all. Yes, sir.
A strange thing, as I came here, I was passing by, kind of looked like a shop, something old thing, and there was a placard, watch, mm-hmm. I don't know in English, and it says, nothing is really difficult.
Ah.
It says on the, now you're just finishing the lecture a little bit.
Yes. The only thing I see that's difficult in spiritual life is convincing yourself to take the steps. Taking the steps is actually very easy. It's quite interesting. I don't remember how old I was. I think I was 10. I was visiting my cousins who lived in a foreign country. And they went to a club that had a big swimming pool. And the swimming pool had a diving board. Do you want to know what a diving board is? It was very high. It was a high dive. I don't know how high it was, but it was very high. And they were all jumping. All my cousins were jumping, and they were telling me I should jump. But I was a little scared. So I walked up the stairs, and I sat up there, kind of, there's like a platform, and then the dive. So I sat on the platform, and I watched people jumping, one after another. I don't know how long I watched, but it was quite a while, until I finally decided, oh, maybe I'll try it. You know, I was really scared. And then I jumped, and it was exhilarating. It was just so exhilarating. I don't remember how long you're jumping, you're in the air for. It was probably at least 20 or 30 seconds in the air before you hit the water. It was a very high dive. And then you went way, way down in the water before you could swim back up. And as soon as I did it once, then it was so exciting that I went back up and did it over and over and over, and they couldn't convince me to go home. So I see that spiritual life is very much like that. We have each step in spiritual life, when you look at it from a distance, it looks very difficult. And you say, well, I can't do that. I can't give up this thing, or I can't accept this thing, and I can't take that step. And what to speak of trying to help others? Oh, it's so complicated. I need to have this thing and that. I need to have this money, and I need to have this thing. And oh, and this person would have to cooperate, and this has to happen. And we're just kind of looking and like, you know, that's a really long way down to the water, you know, I can't do it. And once you do it, once you just say, okay, I'm going to do it, then it's so easy and it's exhilarating. And the more that you do that, then the more you get the courage and the confidence to do it again and again and again and again. And the analogy given in the Srimad Bhagavatam, it says that the material attachments, material illusion, it's like a big ocean. If any of you have been, you're not that far from the ocean here. Probably most of you have been to the ocean. Of course, you're right by the channel. But if you've really been out in the ocean, or like where one of my sons lives is in Hawaii, so you go there, it's the furthest you can get Hawaii, just distance-wise, from any other human habitation. Not time-wise. I think there's some people who live up in mountains where it takes longer to get there. But, you know, there's this huge ocean. So our material attachments and our misconceptions and our illusions seem like that. Seems like this insurmountable ocean. And the analogy is given that the very soft lotus-like feet of Krishna, they're like a boat that's on one side of the ocean. And that saintly persons have crossed this ocean in that boat. So the question is raised, well, if they've crossed the ocean, why is the boat still there? Because, you know, if you cross water in a boat, you take the boat with you. So why, when you look at the ocean, is the boat still there? And the answer is, they don't have to cross the ocean in the boat at all. As soon as they approach the ocean, it's not an ocean anymore. It shrinks to a tiny puddle about this big. That what it says in the sacred writings is that it shrinks to a puddle the size of the indentation a little calf would make walking in the mud. So we don't see very many calves anymore. You could say like a big dog. So if there was some big dog walking in the mud and left some footprint and it rained, and how much water would get in that big dog paw print? And you can step over that. You don't even need to think about it. You don't even notice you're stepping over it. So it looks like there's this ocean. And when you just, as soon as you go towards it, as soon as you say, yes, I'm going to take this next step and I don't know what's going to happen. I'll probably drown in the ocean. You just take the steps and it's gone. And you just cross over. And every step in spiritual life is exactly like that. The difficulty is only in convincing yourself to move towards it, to take the step. That's the only difficulty. Once you actually do it, the difficulty's gone. And you say, oh, that was easy. Why didn't I do that a long time ago? Why was I hesitating so much? And that will repeat over and over and over again. And then after a while, you figure out that that's how it works. And you don't get fooled by what looks like this big ocean anymore. It doesn't put you off. You say, oh, I know how that works. You know, it looks insurmountable, and I just do it, and it's not. And it looks insurmountable, and I just do it. And it becomes, as Srila Prabhupada uses the word, as easy as anything. Yes?
Mataji, I wanted to ask you, actually, could you clarify a bit? I joined ISKCON 20 years ago with a child, and I felt, basically, I've seen a lot of misunderstandings about family life among devotees, which is to my great pain, because I really like family life, and I have a great heart for family, and children. I have two children. I feel so properly situated taking care of my household and my children. And I feel particularly this shelter, this ashram, is so majorly, I'm sorry, misunderstood in our Hare Krishna movement. As a mother, maybe could you a bit elaborate about the glories and the support we can find also in family life and Krishna consciousness?
So it's interesting because There's one place in Krishna book where Prabhupada says that our entanglement in the material world is continuing only because of family life. And then he says, but one can learn from Krishna how to sanctify one's family life. So for most people in the world, the way to become fully enlightened is not to externally give up family life, but to sanctify it. You know, on the one hand, the scriptures glorify the life of the renounced monk. And in one sense, you could say that's the best way. But the question is, what's the best way for me? So, just like if you're going to travel from one place to another, the fastest way is a plane, but you've got to know how to fly one. You've got to have the fuel. It's got to be your plane, or you've got to have the money to rent it. You know, if you just steal a plane and you don't know how to fly it, you'll crash, and then the person who's walking will get there faster. So although the renounced ashrams and the life of a renunciate is very much glorified in the scriptures, that's for the rare few people who can take that path. Most people, if they take that path, they just crash. And then those people who are in family life, they get to the destination where, while the crashed renunciate is recovering in the hospital. You know, the tortoise and the hare kind of thing. So originally, in the society that followed these scriptures, the Vedic society, which hasn't existed on Earth for a long time, but in that society, even you go back several hundred years, basically everybody got married. Everybody got married, people had a lot of children. That was the normal life for most people. And they became renounced, not everybody, but some of the population became renounced when they were older, which is a natural thing also. When people get to be middle age, old age, their children have grown up and moved out of the house, then they naturally want to do things like travel or retire from work. And that was done in the Vedic society, not that just that you retire and play golf or you know, go sightseeing. And where did my parents go when they retired? They went through the Panama Canal and they went to Alaska and they went to Egypt. But you go to holy places. You take your pilgrimage to holy places. You give up being concerned with earning a living and, you know, you're not involved with the day-to-day adventures of your grandchildren, great-grandchildren, but you're more the wise elders of society. And there were few people who took to the path of renunciation from a young age. But that was very unusual. So I see that a lot of the misconceptions in the Hare Krishna movement about family life don't come from our tradition, and they don't come from our scriptures, and they don't come from our founder, but they come from the fact that we're very much also influenced by the societies in which we're raised and brought up. And more and more and more in modern society, I'd say starting probably in the 70s, there's been a movement against family life. So people now, they don't get married anymore. I don't know what the statistics are here in Belgium, but I know that it's much more extreme in the northern European countries than it is in America, but people aren't marrying anymore. If people marry, they marry late in life. It's not that they're celibate, but they don't marry. And they have, you know, one string of this, whatever they have, you know, five boyfriends, five girlfriends, 20, 30, I don't know how many they have. And even they produce children. And if any of you have done this, I'm sorry, I don't mean to offend you. But this is what's happening in modern society. And there's a real push against having children. There's a lot of propaganda against having children. Many people don't want to have any children anymore. They have very few. I was recently in South India, and there were signs, one is best. So there's a strong pushing in modern society against family life. And what I see is that this pushing we bring with us, and when we read things in the scripture about renunciation, we go, oh, I know what that means. You know, that means that you don't get married until you're 35, and in the meantime, you do this and that with other people, and then maybe you just have one child, and you have a very kind of strange family lives. That's where I see basically that it comes from. That we bring in our own biases and our own conditioning unaware. And then when we read the sacred literature and we hear from the guru, we filter it through our own thing and we code it in our own way and then we apply it in our own way. Whereas, I mean, just like this little girl, I just got an email today from someone saying, you know, I bring my young child to the kirtans and people complain. She's 1 year old and people complain that she's running around. Well, you can't get a one-year-old child to just sit still. I mean, for a little while, but you can't just say, okay, to a one-year-old child, please sit and meditate. And this mother was saying, well, you know, I can understand the people don't want their atmosphere disturbed. I said, you know, if you go back to a traditional society, even today in the Indian villages, it's lost now in the cities, it's gone. But in the Indian villages, the children were part of society. There was no separate adult society. They didn't have adult-only clubs and adult-only entertainment, and it just didn't exist. You brought your children with you where you went. There was this fragmentation of society didn't exist. But now it's most of us, and again, in modern society, we can't tolerate children. You're in a room of adults. Probably half the adults there never had a child, or maybe they just had one. Long, long, long ago, and they've forgotten completely what it's like, and they've gotten unused to the funny little noises and running around of the children. And rather than just seeing it as part of life, they see it as a disturbance. So if you're in a society where people are having an average of 6 children, and by the time their youngest has grown up, they're having a grandchild, then there's always children in the society. People are always used to it, and that's just what it is. I mean, another reason is I don't remember who introduced me, but anyway, I spent 30 years as a teacher, and the schools that I ran, we combined the ages, so it was like a one-room schoolhouse. So industrialized society, all of a sudden you had these big cities with this huge influx of children, and they thought, well, how are we going to do this? Well, let's see, why don't we divide them by age? So that was not done because anybody saw it was for the good of the children or the good of the parents or the good of the teachers or the good of society. It was just done because the whole mood at that time was a factory mood. And there were people who actually said, we're following the factory model in our schools. We're going to take the factory model and put it in our schools. And they separated the children by age. That also meant that all the time you're in school, you're growing, you're just with people of your own age. In a natural situation, you'd always be with children who are older than and younger than you, and with a mixed age group. So I see that that's the problem, and because I see that that's the problem, I don't see a very easy solution. You know, we're constantly bombarded with this propaganda from society in general that there's something wrong with commitment, and there's something wrong with children, and the earth is overpopulated. I was at an ecological conference in Hungary, put on by our Hare Krishna farm there, which is so famous for its ecological base that people, professors and students from many universities come there to do studies. And one professor that was not in our organization was giving a speech, and he was talking about how he was just unabashedly saying that he didn't want too many people on the planet because he didn't want to have to share his resources with so many people, that he wanted to make sure that there was plenty for himself. It was quite interesting. And this is really the mood. You know, let me have as much of the... And, you know, you can all tell I'm from America, so the Americans are particularly guilty of this, 5% of the world's population hogging 50% of the world's resources. So how are you going to do that if there's a lot of people? You know, it gets a little inconvenient and embarrassing the more people there are. So it's not that the world can't feed a lot of people. Now, they say you could fit the whole population of the world into the state of Texas and everybody would have 1,000 square feet, and you could feed 10 times the population of the world a vegetarian diet just with the land we're using right now. So that's not really the problem. The problem is greed and misappropriation and so forth and so on. But anyway, we're accustomed to this sort of propaganda. And we bring it with us. And as long as this is coming from the outside society, it's very, very difficult. It's just a very difficult thing. So I think as an individual to recognize that it's not that the other... that my spiritual brothers and sisters are evil or they're cruel or they mean to be repressing, but they're influenced by things that they're not realizing that they're influenced by. And they often don't see the devastation. You know, all of us, each of us as an individual often doesn't really understand the results of our attitudes and how our attitudes affect other people in their lives. We kind of get lost in our own little bubble. And just to see like that with compassion, that people just, they don't realize what influences them and they don't realize how allowing themselves to be influenced in that way is affecting their relationships with other people and affecting the development of a society. And whenever you get a chance, you know, you can make the point that no religious organization has ever survived without at least a decent number of children being born in the society. That no spiritual organization in history has ever survived simply by bringing in new members from outside the society. There has to be children. And those children, not just to have children, but to have children who are properly trained and properly guided from a young age. And without that, you know, I mean, Krishna is all-powerful and he can start another society for his purposes, undoubtedly. But if we want this society to endure, there's no way out of that. We're not going to be successful without that. And also, if we really want to form a society where spiritual culture is intricately intertwined with that society, we have to have people who've been raised in that culture from the beginning, so that their biases and their conditioning are the same as a state of no bias and no conditioning. That they're conditioned to the unconditioned state, so to speak. You know, because when you bring people in from the outside culture, they're bringing in all sorts of misconceptions that take sometimes 5 years, 10 years, 15 years to be cleared off. You know, if you have your homegrown tomatoes, so to speak, you know. So if we really want to change the culture and create a spiritual culture, we're going to have a critical mass of persons who are imbued with that culture. I realized that one day when I was having lunch and I was the only person in the room who hadn't been born and raised in Krishna consciousness. There were maybe 15 people in the room from the age of probably 3 to 25. And they were talking about Krishna in such an intimate and natural way. I was listening to them and I thought, they're talking about Krishna as if he's their neighbor or somebody in their family, somebody they know really well. Whereas someone who takes up Krishna consciousness as an adult, it takes quite a while. You know, first you think Krishna is some sort of philosophical idea before you really are relating to him as a real person. I remember one of those people, the young one, like the three-year-old, I remember when they were playing hide-and-seek one time, she ran up to the altar and she said to the deities, "Gornitai, Gornitai, where's Mukunda hiding?" You know, and I was, somehow when I was having lunch, I could see that these children for whom Krishna is a real person, not a theory, not an idea, not a philosophy, but they were experiencing Krishna's presence from the time they were born, that they could easily change the culture. So anybody who is interested in bringing enlightenment to the world should be interested in there being very stable and loving families which are raising spiritually aware children. So anyway, you asked me something that's very... sorry to go on about it. One of my... Yes?
I wanted to ask if you think of a certain project and you want to give it to Krishna, how do you know that Krishna is inspired with that? That he wants that?
Such a nice question. So if I have a project to please Krishna, how do I know that Krishna likes it? Well, ultimately you'll know because he'll open the doors for you and facilitate you. But you know because you check with the scriptures. You check with Srila Prabhupada. You check with the previous teachers and you see, what do they say they want? And Prabhupada said, Krishna consciousness is not narrow or stereotyped. Actually, one place Prabhupada said, Krishna is not a narrow or stereotyped block. He's a person. So we know what we can't do. We can't sell liquor for Krishna. We can't run a prostitution ring for Krishna. You can't run a murder for hire business for Krishna. I mean, you can't do sinful, violent things for Krishna. You can't run a meat shop for Krishna. So that we know. And then we look within, you know, what is Krishna saying he wants? What is Prabhupada saying he wants? It's very broad. And then you take, what are your interests? What excites you? What are your talents? What are your proclivities? And then you present it. I think of it like presenting it to Krishna as like working in a business and presenting your plan to the company president. I find it very easy to think of Krishna as my company president. You know, and our product is love. Our product is love of God, spiritual love, and it's free. We don't charge for it. It's hard to give it away because people, if they think there's no free lunch, and so they think if it's free, it must not be worth anything. And then we have a plan to market it and to sell it. So we can present it to our boss, and we go to the boss and we say, you know, I have this wonderful plan to distribute spiritual love. Do you approve? And if he approves, the doors will open, without a doubt. And how do you tell that it's a real door? By walking through it, you become more spiritually enlivened. I mean, like it says in the scripture, when you eat food, you get nourishment, relief from hunger, and satisfaction. So when you're doing something that's genuinely spiritual, you get relief from illusion, you get satisfaction. Prabhupada said you don't need to take a certificate from others to see if you're advancing. You don't need to check, like you don't need to check at the meal. Am I eating? Excuse me, am I eating? Have I had enough to eat? Am I satisfied? So it has to be within the scripture. You can't just make it up. It has to be within the instructions of Guru. It has to be within the parameters of the previous saintly persons. So you start with that. You have to start with that. And then you go, okay, how am I becoming more satisfied and more advanced? And am I bringing more love of God to others? It's not really that difficult.
It's a big temple, but maybe it could be too big.
Your plan could be too big?
We have a certain place which could be the new temple.
Oh, don't look at details, my dear.
But it's...
No, not details. Not like that. No, not like that. Details. If you have a plan, if your desire is that you have a nice temple in Antwerp, if that's your dream, you let the boss work out the details. You don't get attached to details. You don't know. And sometimes you seem to go, you know, he'll seem to take you down one road just to teach you something. You know, sometimes it looks like a door opens and you go down that path and then there's a wall and you think, why did I go this way? But it was just to teach you something. So then you're more prepared to deal with the next thing that you come to. And the details of how it unfolds, that's not in our hands. We're not the boss. We're just an employee. No, not a plan with details. Just like Srila Prabhupada was told by his guru, you should teach this knowledge in English to English-speaking people. So at first Prabhupada said, okay, let me write magazines. And then a friend said, you know, people throw magazines away, but they keep books. I said, that's a good idea. So he started translating books. And he tried to make a center in India. And it didn't work. So then he said, okay, let me go to America. He said, everyone's looking at the Americans. If the Americans take it up, then everybody else will follow. But he didn't have the details. He knew, okay, I want to get people to chant Hare Krishna. I want them to read the books. I want to make centers. And he was very flexible. If he was going some way and Krishna showed him was another way, he would go another way. And he would do that all the time. That's part of the development of what we want to ultimately come to, which is spontaneous love for God. Where we're very flexible. Prabhupada says, the purpose of this Krishna consciousness movement is to join in the pleasure dance of Radha and Krishna. And even in this life, even in this body, we're basically, you know, if you've ever danced with somebody, so it's a give and take kind of thing, especially if they're leading. So Krishna's leading. And basically, by offering our dream and our mission, we're making ourselves available to dance. We don't quite know where he's going to take us. But I'll tell you that it will be very exciting. I'll also tell you that wherever you end up will be much better than what you had in your head when you started. Just like we recently did these children's books, where you touch the books, I should have brought them with me, where you touch the books and you can hear each page in 25 different languages, including Dutch and including French, and including German. And you can learn how to read English by going through the books. So I've been wanting to do that for, 25 years? And I thought, it'll take a lot of money, we'll need like $10 million, and we'll need to hire 250 people, or at least 20 people, and we'll have to have a big office, and we'll have to have computers and photocopy machines and this or that. Well, we never had an office. We never had a lot of money. None of that happened. At first, I was working alone in a little room in Australia by a tidal pool and just thinking, I wonder if this is just going to stay in my computer. I wonder if this is just going to end up some files in my computer. And it ended up being something that 200 people worked on and being a world-class system that could compete with anything from Scholastic. It was published by a regular publisher. But I tell you, I sure didn't have the details of that when we started. And it was a year into the project that we found out that we could put sound in the books. We didn't even know such technology existed. We showed a few books to a publisher, and he said, hey, let me show you what we're doing. We looked at it and said, wow. Can we do that? He said, well, I can give you some advice. And after a while, I can help you with this. Well, maybe I can help you with this. Oh, I don't know. I might be able to help you with this. All right, I'll pay for the printing. You know, I had been going to Krishna and said, you got to send me $120,000 to print. That wasn't what happened. It wasn't what happened at all. The publisher said, I'll take care of it. I'll do it. I'll warehouse it. I'll take care of everything. That wasn't in my detailed plan at all. So it was just Prabhupada said, I want children's books. I want books to teach kids. I was just reading that again today. You know, teach them Krishna consciousness through teaching English. So I knew that that was the desire of my guru. I knew it was the desire of the sentient persons. That much I knew. I made myself available and it happened. And sometimes they were blind alleys. Sometimes somebody came and said, we'll do this for you. And I got all excited and they didn't. And I learned something. And sometimes something seemed like an impossible hurdle and it wasn't. So, no, not details. Then we're trying to be the controller. Then we're trying to be the employer instead of the employee. Is that okay? It's hard to let go, isn't it?
No, yeah, but you can sit and wait.
You don't sit and wait at all.
Until it comes.
Who said sit and wait? I never said to sit and wait. I never said to sit and wait.
No, but I mean, you have to actually go in.
Oh, you start something, but without attachment. Without attachment.
Yes.
The attachment is that I'm pleasing Krishna now, and now, and now, and now, and now, and now, and now. No attachment to the result. You have a right to perform your prescribed duty, but you're not entitled to the fruits of action. Never consider yourself to be the cause of the results of your activities and never be attached to not doing your duty. So you present your dream and start on it and see what happens. Do doors open for you? Do you become more enlivened in love for Krishna? Does anyone who meets you become more enlivened in love for Krishna? Do you become happier? Do you become more peaceful? Do you become more free? If you don't, you're doing something wrong. Does everybody who connect with you become happier and more peaceful and more free? If they're not, you're doing something wrong. then you're trying to do it in a materialistic way instead of in a spiritual way. No, don't sit for a moment. Why sit for a moment? Immediately, you start doing something, whatever it may be, and see what doors open and where it takes you. You know, Prabhupada immediately started doing something to teach Krishna consciousness in English. Externally, frankly, it wasn't very successful for like 50 years. But that doesn't mean he wasn't doing anything. He wasn't just sitting waiting for something to fall on his head.
No, I meant, actually, I did already many steps, but so now I kind of have to...
I don't
also in the Krishna Bhakti magazine.
Anyway, I don't know the details. I can just speak in principle.
Yeah.
So, I mean, for this reading book that we did, we took many, many steps 15 years before it got published, and they didn't go anywhere. But we learned something. So, you know, if your dream and your vision is within the Krishna's plan, then it will happen. But how it will happen and when it will happen and the details of when it will happen and who will get the credit, you don't know. That's not... Krishna also... He's a story person. He likes stories and he likes adventures. When we say God is a person, we really mean he's a person. And stories are no fun if you know the ending. Or even you know how. You know, like when people watch these adventure movies of like these, like Superman and whatever, Batman, I don't know, I'm probably really old, I don't know who the heroes are anymore. So, you know, when they watch these things, you know that Superman's going to win. You know because there's going to be a show next week.
Spider-Man.
I never watched Spider-Man. When I was a kid, I used to watch Superman. So you know that there's going to be a Superman show next week. So you know Superman's not going to die. You know he's going to get the bad guy and he's going to live. But you don't know how. And it's exciting. And the characters in the story don't know how it's going to end. So we're supposed to be in Krishna's story. So if we're in Krishna's story, we don't quite know how it's going to end. And sometimes there's this problem and that problem and this thing happens and that thing happens and some monster comes and it's scary. You know, Krishna says, don't worship Indra. Worship Govardhan Hill. And everybody says, okay. And they do it. And they have this wonderful festival, and then their whole village gets flooded. And they don't say, well, Krishna, you know, we're not listening to you anymore. They go to him and say, you told us to worship the hill instead of Indra, and now everything's flooded. He said, okay, I'll take care of it. Then he lifts up the mountain. I mean, that's a pretty out-of-the-box way of dealing with a flood. Imagine, next time there's a flood somewhere, the government just takes some cranes and picks up a mountain. Okay, everybody come into the mountain. But that's the stories. And we're being trained right now, in this life, to enter into Krishna's eternal stories. That's our training. How much do we want to go on an adventure with God? And it's an adventure. It's a roller coaster. It is. And frankly, if you don't like that, there's other options. You can merge into the Brahman where it's just om. And there's no adventure. That's also available. We don't recommend it, but it is available. But it's an adventure. And basically, when you think of how you would like to help in the mission of not only enlightening yourself, but enlightening others, what you're doing, in effect, is you're saying to Krishna, okay, I'm willing to join in your adventure. I'm willing to join in your eternal party. And I don't know where it's going to go, and I don't know where you're going to take me, and I don't know what you're going to do with me, but I'm going to hang on. And I'm going to have fun, because that's what it's all about, basically, is having fun. So again, if you're not having fun, there's something radically wrong. You know, if you're seeing Krishna consciousness as some big kind of struggle, and, you know, if you're seeing... Even in opposition, it should be fun. Even when Krishna, you know, dispatches the demons, it's fun. So we want to go on an adventure. But please don't think that just putting your mission before Krishna, that if it's something that he wants, it means it's all going to turn out the way you have in your head. That probably won't happen. And that isn't even indicative of whether or not he wants it. It's not that if you present something to Krishna that he wants, that means everything is just going to fall into place like clockwork and everything's just going to work out. It's just going to be handed to you. No, it's not like that. It means you're going to go on an adventure. That's the fun. I mean, come on. Krishna could just sit there and say, okay, this, just think it, and instantly it appears. But that's not fun. Our philosophy is that God is a person and that he's having eternal fun. And fun means stories. It means mystery. Don't you like mystery? So it means mystery. It means suspense. It means excitement. It means you think you're going to achieve your goal and you don't. Or you become hopeless and you think you're never going to achieve your goal and you do. And you think that this person's going to help you and this is going to work out and it's not true. And actually they're going to hinder it. And you fall. Person you thought was your friend is actually not so. You thought that this person's going to hinder it, and actually they help you. And Krishna saves you at the end, and he does some incredible thing, and he comes in right at the last minute, you know. And everything turns out wonderful beyond anything you could have controlled or beyond any of your expectations. And you say, wow, I never knew it could be like this. And if along the way we get into the mood of being the controller, or we get into the mood of, I'm the only one who knows how to do it, or it's got to be done this way, or this is what it says in the book, and it's got to be... If we get into that mood, then we usually have to go through some various experiences before we get into the right place and we can cooperate in the whole thing again. And there may be some detours and some... We may kind of be pulled out for a while and be given some more instruction. wait a minute, you're not doing this right. Come over here. Let's stop all this right now. Give you some lessons and then go back in there. So that also happens. And then we think, oh, I guess Krishna didn't like my plan. It's not going to happen. No, he loves your plan. He just didn't like the way you were doing it. And just may work on you for a while and then put you back in. And a while may be, 5 minutes or 5 years or 15 years, depending on a lot of different things. And you may not live in this body to see, also. That's not what we're doing it for. We're not doing something so we can look at it and say, I did that. That's not what we're doing it for. We're doing it for the fun, for the play, for the adventure, for the right now connecting with Krishna. This is the difference between fruitive work and bhakti yoga. Fruitive work is my happiness is in the fruit. So I'm planting the seed, I'm watering the tree, I'm weeding the tree, I'm fertilizing the tree, and I'm not happy while I'm doing that. I'm just thinking, I'm going to get an apple, I'm going to get apples, I'm going to get the apples, I'm going to sell them, I'm going to make money. So fruitive work is very future-oriented. I'm always looking there. When I get there, I'm going to enjoy. I get there, I'm going to enjoy. Now I'm suffering. And now so many problems. When I get there, I'm going to be happy. And then you get there, and maybe your tree didn't give apples that year. Maybe there was a frost and there's no apples. And then you're devastated. Or you get the apples and there's worms in them. So fruitive work is like that. It's basically suffering, 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 suffering. Hard work, hard work, hard work, hard work. Then you get the fruit, and you get the fruit, and either you enjoy it for a moment, and then you get another fruit. We're thinking, when I get there, then I'll just be satisfied. No, fruitive work isn't like that. You get there, and then all of a sudden there's another goal. And you start working for that. And a lot of the time you get to the fruit and it isn't even any good. So fruitive work means occasionally you're happy, periodically in your life, and you don't even know if you're going to be happy or not. You have like moments of satisfaction that may not even work out. And most of your life you're in anxiety and you're trying to control everything and you're thinking that you're the doer and saying, I'm going to do that for Krishna. Okay. That's a little better than saying you're going to do it for yourself. But the mentality is still off. Bhakti yoga is very different. Bhakti yoga is nice explained in the 424 Bhagavad Gita that every moment you're connecting with Krishna. And he's controlling the results. You're not controlling the results. And your happiness is not in the results, which you can't control anyway. Your happiness is in your relationship with Krishna right now. Nobody can take that away from you. No circumstances can take that away from you. Whether your project happens or not in your life doesn't make any difference. Whether other people praise you or not doesn't make any difference. It just doesn't matter. That's Krishna's business. And that's not the source of your satisfaction. The source of your satisfaction is you're giving yourself to Krishna now. And you're dancing with Krishna now. You're reciprocating with him now. And where he takes you and how he takes you and how you get there and what exactly happens and who gets the credit for it, and just doesn't matter. Then you're free. Then you're free. Then you're not affected by other people's opinions of you, negative or positive. You're not affected by how much money you have. You're not affected by how healthy you are. You're not affected by how beautiful you are or how smart or how strong or anything. You're not affected by whether you accomplished anything or not. Your happiness is independent of all of those things. Of course, you're trying to do something externally, but that's not where your happiness is coming from. That's not how you code being successful. Now, people do that in the military. When you're a soldier in the military, you follow orders now. You don't see the big plan. And following orders now may mean you get blown up by a bomb now. And you don't live to see whether the war is won or lost, but that's not the point. So people have this idea of full surrender to their country, which is often, I'm sorry to say, misguided. But at least we can have that idea. I'm giving myself fully. People do that when they're madly in love. If you've ever been madly in love with somebody, that's kind of what it's like. The young boy and the young girl who are madly in love, they're just in the moment being in love. Isn't it? That's what we want to do with Krishna. So when we say we have a mission in his service that we give to him, we're not looking at it as something fruitive. So I hope that's clear. That's a very good point. So it's now 6 o'clock, so we should stop here. I hope that's all right. Thank you very much. All glories to Srila Prabhupada.